You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Carol Becker. She's the author of the small book, Losing Helen. It's a memoir, and it's about her mother, who died at 98 years old. Carol, thanks for being with me today.
It's great. Thank you.
Carol, to understand the form that this book is, which I loved reading as much as you can love reading a book about someone's mother dying. At the beginning of this book, you talked about that you always loved other small books by writers that were about losing a parent. And I had never really thought about that before, that there's a kind of genre like that of people writing about the loss of a parent in memoir form, in kind of a brief memoir form, perhaps. So I guess the first question I want to ask you is, why did you and why do you think writers are compelled to write in this form?
Well, you know, writers are compelled to write. I guess we just say that. And there's probably, I mean, at least for most people, nothing more dramatic than losing a parent or both your parents. I imagine, I mean, I think the worst thing in the world probably is losing a child, but I won't even go there in my thinking or talking. But it's very big and dramatic and life-changing event to lose a parent, and it's especially when it's your second parent and there are no more parents, it becomes a huge event. And I think for writers who spend a lot of their time tapping into their child self and tend to stay particularly close to that child self, there then is a compulsion to give that experience, which has now ruptured your whole adult self, a form. And if you write, then the form is to write a book. What I find is interesting is that these tend to be small books. I mean, there are, I'm sure, exceptions to this, but the ones I think about and the ones that I've loved so much is Simone de Beauvoir's book called A Very Easy Death, or translated A Very Gentle Death. There is, of course, Philip Roth's beautiful Patrimony, and I just reread that because Philip Roth died, and I thought about that book so much and cried through so much of it again. And then there's Roland Barthes wrote just little excerpts, little pieces on pieces of paper, which they put together after Roland Barthes died so unexpectedly, a book called Morning Diary. There's Richard Ford, who wrote a piece about his mother many years ago, and then wrote another piece recently about his father, and put them together and made a book between them. There's Donald Antrim's book called Afterlife. There's so many books that I have thought were so brilliant and amazing by writers who reveal so much of themselves in these books. So it is a genre, I think, and so I always thought my book would be a small book, but I never really intended to write a memoir. Actually, started out thinking I would write a book about rituals of death, and I had been spending time in Laos, and I watched the family next door build a paper house or a cardboard house or a very quickly put together wooden house into which they moved after someone died in their house, so that, and started eating in that new little house, kind of like in a sukkah, that in Yiddish, you know, the Jewish religion, there's a,
right,
they build for spring and harvest, but something like that where the family then would go and eat. And trying to help the spirit leave the main house and go on its path after the person died. And I was very taken with that, and I started reading all these books about, you know, different rituals, different societies, thinking I would really write something like that. And then that's not what wanted to be written. So I started writing a book that ended up being a very personal book, and I was surprised myself by it.
Well, it was a very, very powerful book to read, and you know, it also makes me wonder why I was so engrossed in the book. I mean, I've lost both my parents, and why readers read these kind of books. But maybe that's not really the question. The question is more about talking about death. It's in a way, this was, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people, over 800. This interview seems difficult to me. You know, initially coming into it, like, how do we talk about death and talk about this book? It's not something that we do very often, right? Even around the mourning, you know, sitting Shiva or all these other activities where people get together, we still don't really talk about death. If anything, we share memories, right? It's, and so this book seems to me a little bit of an immersion in that world, which is, which I would imagine is kind of rarefied. We don't do that. We have these rituals, which is kind of like that, but then this book almost, or talking about death, is another maybe more Western ritual that we're trying to develop. I don't know if that's too convoluted, but...
Well, it's interesting to me because I never, in a funny way, never thought that the book was so much about death. I know that sounds odd, but I thought the book was so much about the particularity of my mother leaving. So maybe that's how I thought about it, that, you know, I say somewhere in the very beginning that every death is the same, but every death is so particular. I mean, the end of the story is the person no longer is alive, so the end, the conclusion of the narrative is the same, but everybody's death is so unique. And so I think what I was doing or trying to do was actually to talk about that, the uniqueness of the particular circumstances around which my mother died and the way that she died. And the book has a lot of humor in it. I hope you felt that too. I did.
Yeah.
It's probably because my mother lived in a very sort of his funny retirement community in Fort Lauderdale where people were very funny. And I think that comes through that, so much of the situation, and I think a lot of people have told me who've read the book, that funny things happen around those times that remind you that life is so quirky and odd and that you never know exactly how something's going to play out, even though you think you do. So even when you're in the middle of what feels so tragic or catastrophic at the time, life, the really simple things of life, take over and you find yourself in these really awkward moments of trying to, especially in a culture like ours, where if you're a secular person, if you're not a religious person, you kind of have to invent the ritual. Even if, in the case of my mother, who was Catholic, but everything my mother, you know, but she wanted to be buried in the Jewish cemetery with my father, that became the kind of caper at the center of the story, which was, could I pull this off? Could I get my Catholic mother, who wanted also to be cremated, buried in a Jewish cemetery?
So right, I love that because I have the same, you know, had the same setup. My parents are no longer living, but my mother was Catholic and my father was Jewish.
So oh, really? Oh, amazing.
To that. Yeah.
So then, but then I had to kind of, I wanted to give my mother, and I think this is true of many children, however old you are, you, when you still have parents, you're still a child. You want to do what they want. You want it to be the way they want it to be. And that's what my mother wanted. So, and I didn't know that till after she was dying, and I could no longer even talk about it with her. It was just written on a piece of paper to try to make something happen that was really almost impossible. And I kind of had to be very creative and inventive, and it became very kind of wacky, the whole thing. So in the middle of all of this, and I found that when my father died too, and his unveiling became so hysterically funny. I mean, all these geese appeared from, millions of geese were flocking, and my aunts and uncles were trying to find little stones to put on the grave, and there were no stones, and they were all crawling around. All this crazy kind of stuff happens, and it interferes or breaks up this deep, deep sadness in some way, reminds you that life continues. And so it's a very
all part of the mourning process, isn't it? Just like you were talking about rituals before, but this is about gathering, eating, laughing, also pouring over details, memories, and in the case of an artist, you know, writing a memoir, it's all the mourning process also, isn't it?
That's right. It is, and some people like me and others seem to need a lot of time to do that. It just was a very protracted process for me, and with enormous sadness for a very long time, and took me a long time, and really was my child self that was so sad for so long. And my adult self continued to function in the world, but my child self was very, very sad, and it took a long
and
time.
How long was that, if you don't mind me asking? Because I remember talking with, I interviewed one woman who told me, we were talking, it wasn't the subject of the interview, but an artist, and she said, you know, she played one particular classical piece of music every day in her studio, and she cried for 20 minutes or 30 minutes every single day for a year. And she said after that, it was, things were a little bit different. But that's how she remembered her year. And for me, with my mother, I think, yeah, it was, you know, I don't know, multiple years. Could have been 4 or 5 years or more before I really, in some ways, recovered.
Yeah, and I think that as you see in the book, my mother continued to live very powerfully for me in a sort of spirit way and appeared in various ways to me by different manifestations for a long time. And that kept me connected to her, but it also helped me with the grief because I felt that she was never so far from me. And interestingly, I thought that would appear to people to be very odd and that they would then see me as living in some sort of strange mystical universe. But so many people have told me that they've had so many similar experiences after someone close to them dies with this feeling of the person's presence manifesting in different ways. And people have had all kinds of stories they've told me. And I have my own stories about that. So I kept my mother close, and I continue to keep my mother close, without that dramatic sadness, but with this sense that somehow she's still with me. It's been very important.
So let's talk about that transition, because I think it wasn't quite the right question to say how many years does it take to recover, right? We, in a way, we never recover. But
right. There's
years where you're saying your child self is kind of impaired. Something is really damaged. Your adult self moves on, but something else is, there's a terrible void, for lack of another word. How long do you think it takes, or what is the transition where you move from that to kind of where you're at now, which is you keep your mother very close? And I also relate to what you're saying there on my own level. But what is that transition? What does that mean? Because I don't want to term it as recovery, because it's not, but it's a different way of experiencing your parent when they're gone, right?
Right, and like I said, I think writers do it through writing. Like, because also, you know, their life is, like in the case of my parents, there's nothing dramatic about their life in a way. Like, they're not famous people, they're not, you know, there's not huge accomplishments in the world that you can point to. And yet, for me, and for whoever, whatever parents you have, those people were the center of your universe. So if you take a book like Philip Roth's Patrimony, his father was a life insurance policy salesman. But Philip Roth became this super famous writer. For him, his father was so central to everything he was, and yet, so it was a compulsion, and I think this is true of Richard Ford as well, a real compulsion to tell their story. To make them as important in the world as they are to you. So I think that part of that transition, at least if someone writes or if someone's an artist or a musician, can give it another form. It's a tribute to the person in some way, but it's also a way of taking that shatteredness that you feel. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think the grief is a shattering of the spirit, and having it come back together in a different way, because the really hard thing to accept is your own mortality, of course, and we don't do that well in American society in general. We're not great at that. We don't, as you say, we don't talk about death much, and that's not true in all societies, but it's surely true in this one. We're very adolescent. We're always running to the next entertainment, the next shiny.
Well, we'd rather avoid it altogether, really. I mean, you know,
right.
Maybe not you or I, but I remember when I was talking to my mother's oncologist, he said, it's unusual that you're here. He said, and I said, what do you mean? He said, most families are just next train out of town. You know, they're not around. And so,
I can't imagine that. I mean, I think it depends also, of course, on what the relationship was. Like, if you had a very alienated relationship from your parents, and you didn't love them deeply. And I think that's possible for people. I've known people like that. They didn't feel this great love for their parents. Then the reaction is going to be very different. But so I don't blame or make a judgment at all, because I think where you are when all that happens, how close you want to be, has a lot to do with how you feel.
I think it's a certain amount of bravery, not to be too self-congratulatory, but, you know, I took care of my mother. She was dying. It was kind of a bold thing to do. My sister could have helped or not, but it was, I think, a little too scary for her. You know, I don't think it's an easy thing to do. You're making up your own ritual of what it means to take care of somebody as they're dying. I mean, it on the face of it, that would seem like a terrifying responsibility to take on.
It is,
regardless of your relationship with them, you know.
But I think you're right. I think some people flee from it, and others couldn't imagine being anywhere else. And I don't judge it, because I think we're all different in how we relate and how we process our emotions. And it does, we're not very good in imagining our own death at all. So what, of course, it triggers is you're watching this person who was so big and so strong for you in the physical way when you were a child. Now that person is diminishing and diminishing and diminishing until they're gone. And you know in your heart of hearts that will happen to you too. And that's the part that's just so hard to face. And yet it gives you courage too. It just says, I just feel if my mother, who was so bold and so big and strong, and she went through that, I can go through that too. There's something of that in it. But I miss terribly being a daughter. I really do. I miss the things that daughters do, you know, taking care of someone like that. I missed that when my father died, but I still had my mother. And now I'm not a daughter to anyone anymore. And that, to me, is a huge loss as a role in life, you know, as a giving back in life. And I was so glad I could be there for her. And I was so glad that she and I, because I have no siblings, could kind of, without ever talking about it, figure out what she wanted. And I knew she wanted to be at home and die the way her mother had died. My Polish grandmother had died. And we were able to pull that off. I felt like we pulled it off, my mother and I. You know, we did it.
Right.
We did it. And she didn't survive, but I've survived.
I mean, that aspect of the book that was really about this, you know, almost comical and crazy portion of survival, when you're taking care of your mother, you're in Florida, and you're without electricity in a storm for 2 weeks. Was that what it was?
It was Hurricane Wilma, and it was enormous, and it just, there was no electricity, there was no hot water, there was no refrigeration, there was nothing, and we just had to, they couldn't even get the handle. By now she's at home. We have a hospital bed. It was electrical, but there was no electricity. So then they have a handle that you can do it by hand, except nobody could get the handle because it was locked in a storage place that you needed electricity to open the gate. So my mother was kind of half upright until they could get into that and get the handle, and I could make the bed flat for her. I mean, everything was difficult. Every night it was just candles. But my mother was sleeping all the time. So when I talk about when the hurricane came, when it actually hit, what terrified me most was that I had never thought about it, that my mother was sleeping, now dying, next to these enormous plate glass window in her bedroom. And when the hurricane hit, the glass started shaking. I could feel it on my hand. And I thought, if this shatters and I am alone here and it's 3 a.m. and my mother is in this big hospital bed and my mother was a big woman, what will I do? You know, what will I do? I mean, people's roof blew off their houses during Wilma. People's porches were blown away. It was huge. So, but then
to rehearse in your mind, because that's, you know, how could you possibly imagine what you're going to do? That's just, you know.
I was praying. What I did was I prayed, because I said, I can't, I don't even know what I was praying to, but I just knew that I couldn't handle it. I was all by myself. I needed this not to happen, and it didn't happen. That didn't happen.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but then we lived for the next 2 weeks without any electricity, without any, I mean, it was difficult, but it was the worst had not occurred, you know.
You know, prayer is an interesting term and action when we you know, in talking about this whole process, especially where you're at now and in these 2 weeks, and it was, you know, close to when she's dying. It seems like there's often kind of signs or you know, for lack of a better word, mystical things happening, which are threaded in some ways throughout your book, and especially in one event that I want to talk about towards the end in Rome. But even in that 2 week process, it seems it also and just, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but that it heightens you to other sort of coincidences, for lack of a better word, or serendipity, or events that seem mystical or spiritual in nature in terms of helping you. And prayer seems to point to that a little bit. Is that part of what was happening there?
I think when I say prayer, because I study Buddhism and I read a lot in Buddhism, I think when I say prayer, I'm talking about a higher consciousness, even my own higher consciousness. So I'm praying to know what to do. I'm praying to be the best I can possibly be with the greatest wisdom. So it's like meditation. I mean, that's really what I'm thinking when I'm doing that. And in that, I do, I guess, believe that there is more consciousness than I have available to me at most times. I'm not sure what to call that, but I do live in that kind of mystical state, a part of me does. And that was part of what I was worried about when the book came out. I thought, oh no, you know, I'm a dean, I'm a professor. It's going to look like I live in this wild world.
I'm so glad you said that, because both of my parents were academics, and you're right, the idea of being an academic, a dean, and then talking about something that's mystical or religious in any way seems antithetical, right? That doesn't work.
Well, I was afraid that people would judge that, but interestingly, that was my fear of putting out something so personal into the world. And no one commented on that, because what people said was, oh, I had those kind of experiences as well when my mother died or when my father died. People didn't judge it. They thought people understood that there are times in life, you know, Simone Weil talks about it, when there's like a crack in the ceiling and things come in that normally would not. States of consciousness, experiences you have, you're in a heightened state of awareness and maybe then aware of the fact that this mystical world is always there, but that we are not attuned to it most of the time, because we're so attuned to daily life that we don't notice the synchronicities of things or the magic, you know, the drala, they call it in Buddhism, the magic of the world. We don't notice the magic of the world. And I know that when people are in nature, I know this for myself, and relaxed is when you feel it the most. And you feel it the most also when things are in nature, like a death. A natural thing has occurred that you cannot hide from, and you have to open your heart to it. And when you do that, you have these experiences. It's like they're always there, but we're not watching for them most of the time. Mm-hmm. So I was relieved that nobody actually thought there was anything odd about that, and that was my biggest fear. So now I feel quite empowered to write about anything. I feel like, well, okay, you know, it's just, if I can give it a good shape and form, it will be useful to people too in some way, because it gives them permission to talk about these things that mostly we don't know how to talk about with each other across religion, across culture. In the United States, we're so eclectic. It's not like one society with one way of approaching these things. We have so many societies and so many cultures, and each culture has its way of approaching these ideas. So we don't know even how to talk to each other about it most of the time.
Well, right, and also I think for the reader, you know, we've been talking about where the writer writes this. I think for the reader reading it, it also, for me reading your book, it it imparted some of that magic. Like you're saying, we don't slow down to see these things, and I think we all or many listeners can relate to just that idea of the heightened state of that we're often discussing here, or of dying or caring for the dying, and all the things that can happen there. So reading a book like that imparts a great amount of that, I think, to me as a reader, and puts me into that state of mind, which allows me to embrace the world in a way that I know I want to embrace it, perhaps. And that points to, I've experienced that in other books sometimes, with some kind of little magic comes out of the book. I don't know, Clarice Lispector, I've been reading lately, that happens for me with her.
Oh,
my God. It's like, you know, I know that so intimately. I'm her. I'm not her. I've had that experience. I haven't, you know, all these things. But just like with reading, you know, your book a little bit. So I want you to talk about the point in the book that I can't forget, which is when you were in Rome.
Milan.
Milan, right. Milan,
yeah.
Right.
We were at the Milan Design Fair, and I was with one of my colleagues, Lisa, who from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, where I used to be the dean and where I was the dean at that time, and then Antonio, who is an Italian friend of mine, and we were walking back after dinner late, and it was... Lisa loves my birthday. She always remembers my birthday. You know how you have these people that always remember your birthday? And it was... It was getting close to the hour of my birthday, like almost to midnight, and Lisa started saying, oh, it's almost your birthday, it's like, and sort of counting down, like 10, 9, 8, it was almost midnight. And just at the moment when she said, and now it's your birthday, came out of the sky these balloons out of nowhere. First one, and then a second, and then a third. So it was the three of us each now with a balloon at our feet. And we all just gasped, you know, it was amazing. And then as quickly as they'd come, one left, the second, and the third left. And Lisa was crying and incredulous because she doesn't, you know, really necessarily always live in a magical world. Antonio, as I say in my book, was Italian, so he knew miracles when he saw one. And I thought it was my birthday present from my mother. So it made me cry, and the tears were coming down. We were, you know, Lisa and I were crying, but it was so, it made me feel so wonderful because I felt it was my birthday and she remembered my birthday. And of course, if you think about it, the person who's really there with you at your birth is your mother. So I always felt that my birthday was our birthday because that's the day she gave birth to me. So it was very special, and it was the first year, and it was magical, and it was beautiful, and there have been so many other things like that over the years that have occurred, and often around my birthday. So I put it in the book because it happened, and many of those things that have happened have not had witnesses, but this one, there were other people there, and everyone saw it, and everyone knew it was something unbelievable that it occurred, but it did feel once again like the sky had opened up literally and given this gift.
A miracle, which is, you know, not something we use very often, but it is
And I talk in the book about Renaissance painting in relation to that because I love big narrative Renaissance paintings, you know, Tintoretto and these kinds of paintings where story is being told.
Right, so Miracle of the Slave you were talking about. In the
yes,
book,
right? Like, yes, slave, I mean, yeah. the original cinematic narrative that those paintings represented before film, where they told these really dramatic stories and angels appeared, and I talk in the book about how angels, they're upside down 90 degrees, but their skirts never go up. You know, they're always, like, they really defy gravity, and that's why the book, you know, my little book is so based on Simone Weil's Gravity and Grace, the notion that gravity is death, and the body leaving, and grace is this, moments like this, when everything opens up and gravity is defied, and we have all moments like that. And people who live very dramatically in their bodies have these, you know, great runners or dancers, or you know, when they feel gravity, they don't feel gravity anymore. They're just a above and beyond gravity. And sometimes we have these psychic experiences which are above and beyond gravity too. And I was, so it's all in this little book. This little book has so much in it, and this is just a small book. But thank you also for appreciating it and for even appreciating those moments.
Well, yeah, it is. You're welcome. And it is a wonderful small book. And, you know, even days before this interview, that was the moment that kept coming to mind to me. And it's one of those moments in books that, you know, becomes like the little gem from the book. And I don't know why, but it's just like because it really feels like a little bit of, I thought of it as magic, but it's also
this
miracle, however you want to talk about it. And I thought, you know, how do we ever possess that? And to me, I, you know, feel like reading that as a reader, I possess that somehow, or I am. I can't really articulate it, but it was. But thank you for that, because it's a wonderful thing to share with a reader, and a very difficult thing, I think, to share with a reader.
Well, only difficult, you know, insofar as I thought people will just, either they'll think, they'll be incredulous, and they say, well, this, you know, what's she talking about, you know? Or they will really think I've kind of lost it, you know? And that's why it was scary, like, oh, people are going. But, you know, all of these things are true to experience. So, you know, I don't want to be afraid to talk about the spectrum of human experience. And like I said, so many people have told me stories, that things that happened to them that they couldn't explain in any so-called rational way after a death. And they felt very much the presence of the person, whether it was a bird that was sitting looking at them through the window and wouldn't leave, or, you know, little things that happen that people, all of a sudden that moment is imbued with something that is magic, and they know it and they feel it. It's like something you feel. It's not, it's a kind of experience, a very unique kind of experience. And it's like when you have a dream of something that is prophetic, that you know, you feel it in the dream. When you wake up, you feel, or in the dream you feel, this is actually going to happen. And you know something that you didn't know before. And most dreams are not like that. But when you have one of those dreams, it has a unique quality, and you wake up with this incredible certainty about something. And most people have had that experience too. Mm-hmm. And you can't explain why that happened. And then it may not happen right away, but you know it's going to happen. And I've had many of those experiences. Each time I have one of them, I say, this was definitely going to happen. I don't know when. And then I had one even before maybe a year before my mother died, I had that experience. And I talk about it actually in the book now that I'm saying this, I remember that I actually talk about it. So I think we have these experiences. The question is how much we acknowledge them and how much validity we give to them, how much we're open to them as real experiences, or how much we discount them.
Right. Right. That's so interesting and important, I think. And perhaps, you know, lastly, I don't mean this to be too brief a question, but what is it, you know, in the book you reference kind of becoming the mother. When a parent dies, when we lose a parent, you know, we kind of become that to some degree. And it's often a surprise. I know for me, when my mother died, it seems most devastating in a way and last longest. But when my father died, I remember a friend of mine, an artist, it was A.A. Bronson, actually, who said to me, I said, well, you know, my father died, and I don't know if things will change that much. And he said, oh, no, everything will change. Everything
right.
will change. And I thought, what do you mean? It's not that different. You know, I'm the same person, you know, however I'm working. And he said, no, everything will change. You'll see. And that so scared me.
Yeah.
I didn't know what he was talking
about. I mean, for some people, it's liberating in some way, because if you felt there were things you couldn't do or shouldn't do, or that your parents would react badly to, then there's nothing stopping you anymore. But all the ways in which we define ourselves there's parameters set that have to do with the fact of the hierarchy of eternity. And all of a sudden, there's nothing between you and eternity. Like, you are the next one generationally to leave, you know. And so you have to reframe your understanding of your own life. And I think that's part of the depression that comes with it all, and then you have to get through that. You have to rethink, okay, what okay, I get it. I will leave this planet too. What is it I really want to do? What is it I really want to be? What is it I want to become? And I better get to that. So there's a kind of urgency that comes with it, I think, but also a loneliness. You know, I miss my mother very much. I miss, as I said, being a daughter. I miss, in my case, family, because I am an only child. And some people have other people that absorb that and are still your family. If you don't have that, then it really feels like you don't have that anymore, and you have to reconstruct, or you have to see, well, my friends are that now, you know, if you don't have siblings like I don't. But I think you really have to reframe who you are and how you understand yourself, and your child self is still the same self. It's still there, and you have to take care of that child now because there is no one to project the grown-up onto. You are the grown-up. There's no other grown-up, you know. So I do think you have to rethink yourself in some way, and maybe hopefully it comes with more generosity to yourself and also to others who also suffer, and you begin to understand that so many people go through this. And I think the people who can help you most when you're grieving are people who've been through it themselves. Like, you know what to say to people. You know how to be helpful. You know what doesn't work, you know. And, you know, if someone says to someone, oh, well, your mother was old anyway, you know, that's not helpful because, yes, of course, but it's your mother. It doesn't matter that my mother was 98. Losing my mother was huge, you know.
Right.
Someone saying to me, well, she was
lived
old.
A good life.
You know?
She lived a good life,
you know, whatever it is, any cliche. The people who understand that you're shattered are the people who are helpful because they understand that you're not the same. And that it's going to take time to be unshattered or to heal that shatteredness or whatever you need to do. It's going to take time, and they give you time. But you know that they have that empathy, and most people are afraid to go there if they haven't already experienced it.
Right, Carol. Thank you so much for talking to me about this book. I want to ask you one more question, and
sure.
Of course, there's links here for the listeners to look at the book and consider purchasing it, but I want to just ask you, as I ask everyone at the end of this, what are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading? Well, I'm writing a new piece for an artist named Dan Ruskard, who's a Dutch artist, and so in order to write about that, I'm reading all about artists who were the Earth artists, like Robert Smithson and all of those artists who really were concerned with the natural world. So I'm reading again all the writings of Robert Smithson, but I'm also back reading a beautiful book by Jung called The Earth Has a Soul, which is the nature writings of Jung, which most people don't even know exist, but they're all of his reflections on the nature of nature and what it has to do with the human spirit. So I'm reading that. I'm always reading so many things, but then I pulled out all my Jung books, which I'm reading again, but I'm also reading a person who is that you may know, who is a great theorist, and it's Ernst Bloch, who wrote a book called The Utopian Function of Art and Literature, and his essays on utopia have been really important to me in my own thinking and writing, and the notion of the not yet conscious, and the importance of imagination to imagine what does not yet exist. So somehow all of that's going to come together in a new essay, but I don't know exactly what shape it will take yet. But that's what I'm reading.
Well, I look forward to that. And, Carol, I want to thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.